Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. The unemployment rate for America's youngest workers is a staggering 14.8%. That's more than double the national rate of 7.2%. And it's not just a youth problem. Researchers say the plight of millennials in the job market will have major, long-term repercussions on the overall economy if something doesn't change fast. This hour, we're exploring the challenges facing young Americans as they seek to enter the job market and some suggested policy changes that could make a big difference. Sarah Ayers is an analyst in the Economic Policy Department at the Center for American Progress, where her work focuses on a range of issues affecting shared economic growth. Sarah, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeffrey Madrick writes an economics column for Harper's Magazine. He's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, editor of Challenge Magazine, and director of the Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Roosevelt Institute. His most recent book is Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. Jeffrey, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, let me start with you. How did we get to the point where the unemployment rate for people aged 25 and under is now approaching 15%?
Well, I mean, I think what's really clear is that this economy is failing millennials. So, like you said, the unemployment rate for young Americans is more than double the national unemployment rate. It has been in the double digits for years. And according to our research, there are 10 million Americans under the age of 25 who are not able to find full-time work today. And this is, you know, going to have a variety of consequences, both for individuals and also for the economy in the form of reduced growth in the long term. So I think it is really important to note that this isn't just a millennials issue, but this is something that has the potential to hold back our economic growth for years to come.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit and talk about some of the factors that have gotten us here. Certainly, we've had the recession, which has had a huge impact across the board. Why are young people, though, disproportionately affected? And what are the factors that have led to that?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that we don't have enough jobs in this country. And when you have a situation where you don't have enough jobs and employers are looking to hire someone, they're probably going to hire one of the older workers who has more experience as opposed to a younger worker who is just entering the workforce and might be more of a risk because they don't have that experience. So I think younger workers are always going to have higher rates of unemployment than older workers, but obviously, you know, at 14%, the rate of unemployment among young workers is really unacceptable.
It's interesting what you say about older workers, because for some time the conventional wisdom was that younger workers would be chosen rather than older ones because they can be had oftentimes for less money, and that many employers would be willing to sacrifice the experience to help the bottom line.
Yeah, well, the sad truth is that wages in this country have been stagnant for decades. So, you know, older workers aren't, employers can hire older workers for less, for about the same as they would hire younger workers.
Hmm. And Jeffrey, if our research is correct, it seems that older workers, 55-ish plus, seem to be the ones who are doing the best, perhaps, in the job market or entering at the greatest rate, correct?
Well, their participation rate or their employment to working to population rate is the over 55s are the only ones whose ratio has gone up in this economic recovery. I think it's important, in addition to looking at the unemployment rate, to look at this employment or participation rate or an employment to population ratio. Those 21 to 25, that employment ratio has plummeted by 10 percentage points in 10 years. That's remarkable. So I don't think it's just necessarily this economic devastation we've been going through. The other point we should be thinking about a little bit is the plight of teenagers, 16 to 19. They don't get summer jobs anymore. I mean, the employment to proportion of teenagers has absolutely plunged in the last 10 years. Now, there is a relationship. Some economists have done work on this. There probably is a strong relationship between getting teen work and your future employment record. So something even beyond the last 3 or 4 years, if you completely agree with Sarah, it's been a dreadful jobs recovery. And the primary problem is we're not growing fast enough, and the primary solution is more fiscal stimulus and maintaining monetary stimulus to get this economy growing again. But something else must be going on, and I think it's a bit of a mystery about why the young are so disproportionately affected by a poor employment situation. One quick last point. Even before the 2007, the job market in general was growing at the slowest pace. That is the George W. Bush recovery. Jobs were growing at the slowest pace in any comparable period since World War II.
Let me ask you about a couple of points that you brought up, starting with summer jobs and teens. I was reading that it's something like 30% that now have summer jobs as opposed to an average of 50-something percent in decades past, and that it's worse for African-American and Hispanic teens. Tell us a little bit more about what that drop means, because you talked about the relationship between teens having jobs and their success later on. What's the correlation there?
Well, I think the correlation is pretty high. It's always a little difficult to work that out precisely, but some people have done analyses and regression analyses and so forth to show there is a relationship between poor employment in teens and poor employment as they get older. In fact, the drop in teen employment, I'm actually looking for the data, is worse than you just suggested. And very poor, as usual, for people of color. So I think what disturbs me most is that nobody seems to be talking about it in the nation. People are talking about youth employment a little more. Thank goodness for Pope Francis. But partly it's because it is so much worse in Europe. That is, since the recession, it's so much worse. But interestingly, and I want to mention this, and that's for fear we won't get to it later, Europe is actually trying to do something significantly more aggressive about their youth unemployment than the U.S. is. They are actually attacking the issue, and we're just paying lip service, if any lip service at all.
Why is that, Jeffrey? I know you mentioned that Europe is working on it, and I did read something about $8 billion set aside to help create opportunities for youth. What's going on here in the U.S.? Is it partisan politics in Washington, or how can we account for that?
Well, I think it's this general austerity attitude, the conservative nature of the country at the moment. We tend to, you know, I've read articles where people think the young and teenagers just don't want to work. They just want to stay home and live with their parents. People actually make this point. It's very hard for me to believe anybody can take that seriously. I know when I was young, and probably when you were young, we all wanted to get out of the house if we could afford it. So the idea that we want to stay there, it strikes me very odd. So there are two things going on. The most important is some self-imposed idea that we can't afford social programs. The deficit is not an issue now. We can increase social programs. We are doing the opposite under sequestration. That's number one. The deficit mania is our biggest psychological problem. But number two, in general, Americans have not been much concerned about poverty in the last couple of decades as the nation became more conservative, even going back to the late 1970s. So we have a change of attitudes about social programs that I think is seriously harmful. And we have a lot of room to raise taxes compared to other rich nations. We're near the bottom of the pack in terms of federal, state, and local taxes as a proportion of income. And some countries that have very high government as a government spending as a proportion of income do far better than we, or significantly better than we, in terms of GDP and equality issues and quality of life and certainly healthcare and educational quality.
Sarah, I'm interested to hear your observations as well, not only as someone who is involved in creating policy, but as a millennial yourself. I'd like you to talk a little bit about what Jeffrey just pointed out about the need for more programs. I think about AmeriCorps, for instance, programs that were created in the past to increase youth employment, service programs, for instance. What's your experience been with that, and where do you see the greatest need?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we need to invest in job creation, both specifically for young people, but also broad-based job creation. And the president, you know, in 2011 did propose the American Jobs Act, which would have created 1.6 million new jobs. So I do want to give credit where credit is due, because the president has put out these proposals. The Senate has also approved a summer jobs program for youth as part of the immigration reform package. So there are lawmakers who are paying attention to this problem and trying to address it. But, you know, overwhelmingly we have a Congress that has been focused on austerity, as Jeff mentioned, which is actually holding back our economy, you know, in addition to not creating jobs. You know, and not to disparage what I do here, but job creation is not rocket science. You know, we know how to do it. The Recovery Act created 3.5 million jobs. So, you know, we need to focus on programs that will do that. And you talked about national service, which I think is a really important way to give young people experience while also helping communities that are very much in need right now. So programs like AmeriCorps have 5 times the number of applicants than they have positions. So we would propose creating 1 million new national service positions to help connect young people to these opportunities that, you know, are not high-paying jobs, are not career positions, but are opportunities to develop work skills and connect them to the labor force in a way that they otherwise might not be able to do in this economy.
What do you think it would cost to create those jobs?
I don't know what it would cost. I know that, you know, national service positions are one of the more cost-effective ways to get young people working, simply because they are such low-wage positions. But I really think we can't afford not to invest in creating economic opportunities for this generation. You know, one thing that I don't think we've talked about yet is kind of the long-term scarring that occurs as a result of unemployment at a young age. So research has found that when a young person is unemployed in their early 20s, they will actually go on to earn lower wages over the course of their lifetime as a result of that unemployment.
I'm going to stop you right there, and I'd love to follow up with that thought. We're about to take a quick break. We're talking about the plight of millennials in the job market here on Radio Times, and when we come back, we'll take your calls as well. Radio Times will be right back.
Enchantment Theater Company supports WHYY and presents its new production, Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales. Aladdin discovers a genie's lamp in a hidden cave. Sinbad sails to distant lands where he rescues an enchanted bird. The Kalandar Prince battles a fiery dragon. Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales, December 17th through the 30th at Arts Bank Theater on the Avenue of the Arts in Philadelphia. Giant puppets, spellbinding magic, and enchanting music. Ticket information at enchantmenttheater.org.
April 15th may be months away, but now is the time to get your last-minute tax deduction. Support WHYY now to help us end the year on a high note. Whether you give a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, our pop culture critic Renee Graham joins us and says the most exciting films are not coming from Hollywood, they're coming from Korea.
They're incredibly original. They cross genres, there's a lot of dark humor, there's action. I just think they're fantastic.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we are talking about the plight of millennials in the job market. The unemployment rate for those 25 and under is now 14.8%. It's more than twice the national average. We've been talking about the difficulties that millennials are having entering the job market. And in a moment, we're going to be talking about the long-term repercussions of that. Our guests are Sarah Ayers. She's a policy analyst in the Economic Policy Department at the Center for American Progress. Jeffrey Madrick is with us as well. He writes an economics column for Harper's Magazine, is a contributor to a number of others, and has also his most recent book is called Age of Greed: The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. We welcome your calls and your comments or questions for our guests. Perhaps you are a millennial, you're the parent of a millennial, you work with them, or have some other stake in this issue, but we'd love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. Sarah Ayers, when we left off, you were talking about the long-term effects of entering the job market late, of not getting great jobs to start off with. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because what are the long-term effects for young people who are just having so much difficulty getting into the market?
Right, and this is what makes youth unemployment in particular such a pernicious problem, because the effects are going to follow us for so long. So research has shown that workers who are unemployed at a young age go on, once they start working, to earn lower wages for the rest of their lives due to that lost experience in their early 20s. And there's actually a number that we can put on that, and it's about $22,000 per worker over the course of 10 years after they experience that period of unemployment in their early 20s. So this is something that, you know, obviously is hurting individuals right now, but is, you know, going to have long-term repercussions.
Jeffrey Madrick, let's talk about the long-term effects on the economy as a whole.
Well, clearly, America needs good workers. When young people don't get jobs, it means they're not going to be as good as they could have been in terms of contributing to the economy. It's clearly it would be in our selfish interest to get these people into jobs, get them trained, get them to become good workers, learn the social skills necessary to do their jobs well, and to improve their own lives. We are not disposed to do this, and I want to make this very clear to your listeners. America, not only are we not helping young people enough through the kinds of programs Sarah's suggesting, and programs we know something about, like AmeriCorps, a large part of the legislative body wants to kill them. The Republicans wanted to kill AmeriCorps, a rather inexpensive program the Clintons started to try and get young people to work. They literally wanted to kill the thing. It's almost hard to imagine, and look at the consequences of not helping them today. So, and actually, I think there is a group of people, a social research body, highly respected one, analyzed what they now call opportunity youth. Young people in their early 20s who are neither going to school nor have a job. This is truly the lost generation. They estimate about 7 million of them between the ages of 16 and 24. And the lost wealth to the economy, they figure, and this is not particularly a progressive organization that's done this analysis, over a lifetime comes to, when taking everything into account, comes to an astonishing $1 million a person. Remember, I'm talking over a lifetime of lost income to the economy and to themselves. Multiply that times 6.7, and you're talking about some real bucks here. So we're just turning away as a country. This is not merely neglect. It's deliberate neglect. We don't want to deal with it in an age of austerity. And it's very clear, to reinforce what Sarah said, and doubly and triply reinforce it, we need job creation programs to get them a start. It's never been, relatively speaking, as bad for youth in the post-World War II period as it is now.
Hmm. Sarah, I want to talk about some of the problems that come along with this in terms of this causing millennials to really delay their entry, not just into the workforce, but into adulthood in general, right? I mean, you think about growing up, buying a home, those kinds of things. So now all of those things are getting pushed back.
Right. I mean, you already see the consequences of youth unemployment, and it's exacerbated by the fact that young people who do have jobs are also struggling to make ends meet because they're overwhelmingly faced with low wages, non-existent benefits, poor job security. And you have the situation where college has long been viewed as kind of the ticket to a good job and a middle-class life, but the cost of college has gone up 250% in the past 30 years. So as a result, student debt levels have gone through the roof, and you see that young people are moving back home with their parents. They're not buying cars and houses. And you even see some evidence that young people are putting off marriage and having children as a result of these economic challenges.
Yeah, they're carrying so much debt that there's a reluctance, I guess, to commit to marriage, to buying a home, to those kinds of long-term commitments for a lot of young people.
Even if they have a job, they don't feel secure about them. They don't feel secure about their job. Excuse me for interrupting, but also when they have a job, their wages are far below, both for men and women, far below what they were adjusted for inflation in the late 60s and early 70s. It's pretty shocking how much. Usually we talk about women's wages rising. Young women's wages are well below what they were in the late 60s.
You raised a couple of interesting things there, Jeffrey. Is there any, do you see any breakdown in gender differences for millennials entering the job market? Is it tougher for men or for women, or is it equally tough for everybody?
Sarah may know this better than I. I don't have the unemployment data on women versus men right in front of me, but women's wages haven't gone down as much, if that's an indication. But I'm sorry, I just don't have the precise answer on that.
In terms of unemployment rate, there's not a huge difference between young women and young men. Where you do see the difference is by race and ethnicity, where young people of color have much higher rates of unemployment than white young people.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Sarah, what about discouraged workers? So often when we think of discouraged workers, those who have just stopped looking after a period of time, we tend to think of maybe older workers who have had decent jobs, they've been laid off, or for whatever reason have found themselves out of the workforce. What about millennials? Do we have millennials who fall into that category now of discouraged workers?
We do. Like I said, there are 10 million young people today who aren't able to find full-time work. So that includes young people who have dropped out of the labor market, who are also not in school. So when you talk about a young person who has dropped out of the labor market, who isn't in school, this is someone who isn't building skills, who's not making connections, who isn't gaining work experience. Basically, we have millions of young people who are not developing human capital. So it's really a recipe for disaster when human capital is such an important part of making the economy grow in the long term.
Well, and I want to talk about the dropout rate as well, not from the job market so much, but from school in general. The dropout rate is more than 1 million a year, if I understand it correctly. How does that contribute to the problems that we're seeing? I mean, you've got those who are perhaps going to college and then having difficulty finding work, but you've got a lot of young people who aren't even finishing high school.
Yeah, it's a big problem. As our economy grows, increasingly young people need some form of post-secondary education. So they need a high school diploma, and they also need some form of post-secondary education in order to get a good middle-class family-sustaining job. So for those young people who do drop out of high school, and even those who end their education with only a high school diploma, they're going to have dwindling job opportunities and lower wages and higher unemployment going forward.
Jeffrey, did you want to weigh in on that?
I had slightly different numbers than Sarah, but the same ballpark. So, as I mentioned, the study finds many millions of young people, 16 to 24, who neither go to school nor have a job. Clearly they are lost souls for the moment. There are programs, especially at local and state levels, that try to get these people back. But one of the most interesting findings in this survey is that these young people want to go to school and want to work and are even optimistic that they will go to school and or work. Many of the local, state and local programs are try to get them to both go to school and work at the same time and build those not only those schools, but I think a sense of optimism and self-control that they clearly don't have. A lot of these young people come from socially disadvantaged circumstances. So really, a far-seeing America would work at the much harder at the very beginning, at the level of childhood, and even earlier than childhood, my pet issue for 2014 and my institute at the Roosevelt Institute will dedicate itself to childhood poverty, which I think is the biggest social problem. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the rich world, the richest country in the world with the highest rate of childhood poverty. Hard to believe. But I believe these issues begin back then. So, when I read, say, in the New York Times editorial, the key problem is gaining equal access to quality education for more Americans, K through 12, that's just not good enough. The idea of placing on the K through 12 system the burden of getting these people back into full-fledged into society, making them optimistic contributors, let me use a mild word, inadequate. It's not grossly negligent. We've got to start earlier than that. So we've got to do this at both ends. We've got to get jobs for these high school kids, get programs for them, college kids too, and college graduates who are suffering. In the last 10 years, the average salary for a college graduate has not gone up at all. And economists galore tell them, just get yourself educated and you'll be okay. It just hasn't worked out that way. We're not addressing this analytically enough.
Well, let's go to the phones to Allentown and Jason. Welcome, Jason, to Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a retail manager, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people over the last several years. And one thing that I have found is I find that a lot of the 19 to 25 or 26-year-olds, entering the job market, there's a lot of jobs that they don't necessarily want to do. They don't necessarily want to start at the bottom to work their way up. A lot of their salary expectations are really high. And I know for myself, being in my early 40s, when I entered the job market in the early 90s, I was willing to take lower paying jobs. And I think a lot of that discipline comes from parenting. One of your guests mentioned something about students not getting summer jobs, and I think that's a big part of it, because those experiences prepare you for the interview process and prepare you for the workforce, so that when you do get interviews, you're more likely to gain employment. That's just a comment that I had.
Well, thank you, Jason, for your call. Sarah, what do you say to Jason's comments?
Well, I would say low wages in the early 90s were a lot higher than low wages today. I mean, the value of the minimum wage has declined significantly over the past couple decades. So when we're talking about, you know, applying for a minimum wage retail job or fast food job or what have you, it's simply not a it's not a family sustaining wage. It's not a wage that can keep a full-time worker with a family out of poverty. So, you know, I don't think the issue is that people are, you know, too lazy to work these jobs. They actually are working these jobs, and they're not getting by.
And it has been...
Can I reinforce that? As I think Sarah makes a very good point. We've lost perspective about how low wages are, especially at that low end, compared to what they used to be. You used to be, I'm not saying you could raise a family on a minimum wage even in the early 1990s, but it was a wage that could get a single person at least a modest living. Now it just isn't. And we, you know, over time you lose perspective. You think everything is comparable to what it was back then. And I'm sure the gentleman who called pays a decent wage, but we know how poorly places like Walmart pay their workers. So, you know, the times are significantly different now than they were in the past in terms of wages. And the data are clear. Wages for these young people, when they take jobs, are much lower than they were just for inflation in the early 70s and late 60s.
Let me go back to the phones quickly to Norristown and Steve, and perhaps we can respond to Steve's call after the break. Steve, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you doing? I am a millennial. I graduated college about 3 years ago and have done three internships and an AmeriCorps service, but am still finding that a lot of the entry-level positions are just not there. And I'm seeing a lot of companies still hiring for interns, but not hiring as an entry-level position or having the internships move on into that position. So I think that's a big problem with our economy right now, is that a lot of the entry-level positions are moving into and becoming just internships.
Mm. Steve, thank you. That's a good insight. Sarah, have you seen that as well? That now there's a move toward hiring interns as opposed to entry level employees, with all that implies.
Yeah, there certainly is a growth in unpaid internships, which I think is a big problem and should be addressed. One of the policies that we're really excited about here at CAP is expanding apprenticeship as a way to connect young people with well-paying jobs. So, you know, unlike an internship, an apprentice is actually a paid employee who is getting an education and worker training as they're progressing through their apprenticeship. So we think that, you know, although it's relatively uncommon in the U.S. today, expanding apprenticeship can be a good way to really create pathways to middle-class jobs for young people.
When we come back on Radio Times, we want to talk about some of the solutions. Both of our guests have lots of ideas on how this problem can be addressed and what some effective solutions could be. So we want to talk about that. We want to hear your comments, your questions as well for our guests as we talk about the plight of millennials in the job market and how their unemployment rate now is at 14.8%. They are doing worse than perhaps ever in recorded history in the job market right now. You're listening to Radio Times. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499, and we'll be back right after this.
Longwood Garden supports WHYY. This year, Longwood celebrates the holidays with a Longwood Christmas, fresh and in season, featuring fruit-adorned trees, 18,000 floating red and green apples in a mosaic, daily performances, and a half million twinkling lights. A Longwood Christmas, fresh and in season, on view every day until 10 p.m., now through January 12th. Timed tickets are required. Tickets and information are available online at longwoodgardens.org. This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM. We know that roughly 30% of us have some symptoms of insomnia. We know that there's a relationship between insomnia and depression, heart disease, auto accidents, and on. But many of us still brag that we don't really need much sleep. On the next Voices in the Family, understanding sleep and learning about effective non-medication treatments. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about millennials in the job market and the difficulties that they are having right now. Our guests are Sarah Ayers, a policy analyst in the Economic Policy Department at the Center for American Progress. Also with us is Jeffrey Madrick, who writes an economics column for Harper's Magazine, among other publications. The number to call, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. And Sarah, I want to pick up on some things that you were talking about before we went to the break. We talked about jobs creation, and we want to focus at this point on some of the proposed solutions, the policy changes that your organization and others are recommending. But clearly, this is not just the responsibility of the government, right? I mean, there's a responsibility on the part of the private sector here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we've proposed expanding apprenticeship, because that is a way to really get employers in the game and, you know, working to help alleviate what some employers are saying is a skills gap, in that they, you know, have jobs that they want to fill, but they don't have workers that are qualified to fill them. So we believe that apprenticeship is one way that employers can begin to develop the skilled workforce that they need, while also connecting young people with paying jobs that will lead to, you know, a long-term sustainable career.
What are some of the other policies that you and your organization are looking at and putting forth as potentially solid solutions to the problem of millennials in the workforce?
Yeah, as I said before, we need broad-based job creation, as the president has proposed in his budget. We should be putting people to work, rebuilding America's infrastructure, rehiring teachers and, you know, other public service workers. We should be implementing a summer jobs program like the one that the Senate approved earlier this summer, like the one that was in the Recovery Act that created nearly 400,000 jobs for young people in 2009 and 2010. And we should also expand national service opportunities to give young people an opportunity to develop skills while serving their communities.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, I'd like you to talk about that as well. Sarah mentioned, among other things, infrastructure jobs. Certainly there's a tremendous need for that in our country, and yet the jobs don't seem to be there. What are some of the things that you've been thinking about in terms of addressing this problem of millennials in the workplace?
Well, infrastructure is a kind of win-win-win, except in the U.S. Congress, it seems. We need, as we hear endlessly, and it's true, our roads and bridges are inadequate for a modern economy, especially in a globalized world. We don't adopt and modernize these transportation systems. That's number one. So it helps the economy's productivity to begin with. We can ship faster, we can get to work faster, and so forth. Second, it creates jobs, and usually good jobs. Third, we can aim some of these jobs at youth. When government is providing the money, it can create rules about who gets employed. So infrastructure would be a great way to begin to do this. But you talked about private sector's responsibility, and to quote Adam Smith, I wouldn't count on the benevolence of, I'm updating him some, the benevolence of the private sector. I think we need push and pull from the federal government. So we can talk about subsidies for youth employment. We can talk about direct job creation programs that get them out there and working. There are such construction programs, a program like Youth Build. But these are minimally funded programs. Well, we have to think in terms of billions of dollars, I think, to get youth rehired in America. I think it's fine that the president talked about teenage jobs and so forth in 2009. He hasn't much talked about it again. He hasn't much talked about child poverty maybe recently. I think in some sense Sarah is giving the president too much credit. He is mostly, for most of his term, has been worried about the budget deficit. He had a budget. He announced a budget summit even before he became president. He did change after a disastrous midterm election to start talking about jobs. But it's been, from my point of view, too little too late. It's the overriding problem in America. After all, what's an economy supposed to do but create jobs? And some of the problem goes all the way back to Wall Street. So at Roosevelt Institute, we're coming up with a list of 15 or 16 jobs programs. Some of them will sound mildly radical to some people, but we don't call it a jobs crisis. We call it a jobs emergency. And we really haven't caught up as a nation in terms of the consciousness of how bad the situation is. And it isn't all globalization. Of course, we should be raising the minimum wage, which will help young workers. As I say, they're getting paid too little. We've discussed that quite a bit.
Well, I want you to hold that thought, Jeffrey, because you brought up some things that I'd like to ask Sarah about, and I want to circle back to the cost issue. Sarah, as I'm looking at some of the proposals that you have put forth at the Center for American Progress. For instance, you talk about infrastructure, and it says Congress should immediately invest $50 billion to put Americans to work rebuilding our nation's crumbling infrastructure. In another section, Congress should invest $35 billion to rehire some of the hundreds of thousands of teachers and other public service workers who lost their jobs in the aftermath of the Great Recession. Congress should invest $8 billion in creating subsidized employment opportunities for low-income and long-term unemployed workers. And so I go back to one of the points that Jeffrey made. There's bound to be somebody in Washington who would say, hey, we're facing, you know, a deficit that's bigger than it's ever been before. Where does the money come from, these, you know, tens of billions of dollars to invest in to get people back to work?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's just not true that we have a deficit crisis in this country. We have an economic growth crisis that should trump our deficit concerns. You know, since 2010, when we really started focusing on reducing the deficit, we've made tremendous progress in doing so, and it's now time to really turn our focus to investing in job creation and growing the economy.
Are these ideas getting traction, Sarah? I mean, what's happening in Washington at this point? Is anyone beginning to talk about some of these ideas about investing in infrastructure, about getting teachers back on the job, and some of the other proposals that CAP has put forth?
Not nearly enough. So like I said, the Senate did approve a measure that would create a summer jobs fund for young people, which I think is important, and the House should move to adopt that as well. But yeah, I mean, Congress has not done nearly enough to focus on economic growth. We've largely been obsessed with austerity and these damaging spending cuts that are really holding back our economy.
Yeah. Let me go back to the phones to Cherry Hill and Yanni. Welcome, Yanni, to Radio Times.
Yes, so I actually ended up having to go back to school to get my master's. I am a millennial at 25, and one of the situations we're talking in our class is that higher education is truly failing college students right now by not creating transferable skills, and they're coming out with thousands upon thousands of dollars in debt, and the debt load amongst students and millennials is topping the debt load for people with mortgages. So not only can they not get jobs, we're not able to invest back in the economy, so now you've got a cyclical cycle, and I'm curious what the guests feel about how can we stop the cycle from constantly going round and round when we've got a $1 billion debt crisis for millennials right now?
Yanni, thank you for your call. Jeffrey, what do you say to that, the responsibility of universities in all of this?
Well, I think actually they do have some responsibility. We have a star system at our major Ivy League and similar universities. That is often appalling, professors getting huge amounts of money. We have country, boy, I sound like an old fogey, don't I? I did a seminar at an Ivy League school recently, and a school I went to, and I couldn't get over the benefits of belonging to the school in terms of country club type benefits. The facilities are extraordinary, but there's a competition. There's a competition in nicer dorm rooms. There's a competition in beautiful libraries where you can sit and have a cup of coffee and socialize with your friends. All of that's probably mildly conducive to learning, but I doubt it's critical. So we really have a competition across the board in universities that I think has to be stopped. And again, I wouldn't count on their benevolence because, in a way, it's a free market. And the market is make your product better and charge more, utilize some subsidies from government to help some of the kids go to college, but allow them to take on enormous amounts of debt because of the promise, a deep American promise that goes back a very long way, that with a college education, you will have a decent and even very decent life. Mm. And we know, and we've talked about this repeatedly, we know it's not paying off that way anymore. And the kids face enormous debts, and we can begin to develop debt relief programs rather easily, frankly. And I think the banks should be taking some responsibility and helping alleviate that debt.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one last call from Elkins Park. We'll go to Merrill. Welcome, Merrill, to Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I am the parent of a millennial, and she entered the Peace Corps after graduating from NYU and came back to this jobless economy, and she's had internship after internship, all unpaid, and that's part of the problem. But the biggest problem I see is that she would send out applications to jobs all over the country, hundreds of them, and never received a single response. So it seems to me that even if you provide these younger, you know, high school and 20-somethings with job opportunities through the programs you're talking about, where are they going to be able to get jobs? How is the system going to be able to work for them to be able to get employed when they go beyond that? Because to me, the system is completely broken. The first time she got a response was when she applied for a job over in Germany, and immediately the next day they responded to her and said, "We received your application and we will consider blah blah blah." And the most appalling thing to me was when I suggested that she use her NYU career placement. They wanted to charge her $150 for a half-hour interview.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, Merle, thank you for sharing that. I'd love for our guests to comment on your daughter's situation and the point that you made about even getting an acknowledgement as our millennials are applying for jobs. Sarah, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that we are facing our economic growth is too slow and we are creating too few jobs. And that is where you have a situation where, you know, hundreds of people are applying to one job opening, and not to let employers off the hook for not responding or offering some sort of response. I think they should. But it's really a symptom of, you know, our slow economic growth and poor labor market opportunities for young people. To which the solution is investing in job creation.
Mm. Well, and I think the whole online piece of it, Sarah, has contributed to that as well. I know from my own kids just applying for jobs, they're college kids, and everyone's saying you have to apply online, and then they feel as if their application gets lost in a pile somewhere and they're never heard from again.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I think, you know, it's a terribly sad situation. I know almost nobody in America who is a parent of children or teenagers or young adults who isn't worried to death that they will have a future. This is the real America now. And somebody's got to knock on the wooden heads of people in Washington, and I include the White House in this. I just don't think they've been nearly aggressive enough or used the bully pulpit in a serious way. I even hear talk of people suggesting that Americans leave, that young Americans leave the country, like that woman who said she only got a job response from Germany. Not that Europe's doing very well. Their austerity economics is very poor in a few countries that are, and that's a whole different can of worms. But we really got to address this. The fact is we did create jobs in this recovery, not enough, but the ones we created, the large majority, were crummy jobs, crummier on average than we used to create. So something very serious is going on here, and we got to address it, not merely a matter of putting our heads together, but getting a sense of how serious the nature of this problem is, and that it's not going to be solved without government. Private enterprise, cutting regulations, cutting business taxes and so forth, they're just not going to do the trick. They had their chance, private enterprise. And we created, I think now, on balance, no new jobs in the last decade, 2000 to 2010, or relatively few compared to 20 million in each of the decades that preceded it.
It was something like 2 million, I think, in the last 10 years, was it not?
Yeah, I'm not even sure it's that. I think that is a number that's slightly exaggerated, and I use that myself.
Well, let's end with this. Sarah, your advice, you are a millennial, you are working on policy. What's your advice to people your age who find themselves in this situation?
Well, I mean, we really need to lobby Congress to shift their focus from austerity to economic growth and creating job opportunities for our generation. And, you know, I think you do see that young people are taking action on this. You see the fast food workers, most of whom are young workers, have been striking to lobby for higher wages and the right to form a union without retaliation. And that's, you know, exactly the kind of effort that we need to see.
Sarah Ayers is a policy analyst in the Economic Policy Department at the Center for American Progress. Sarah, thank you for being with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
And Jeffrey Madrick writes an economics column for Harper's Magazine. He is an author as well. Jeffrey, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.